Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When online education hit higher ed, American colleges, many expected it to revolutionize the way universities do their work. Then came lots of second guessing about how and when. Now, more and more universities are not only offering online courses, they're offering online degrees, including a $7,000 master's in computer science at Georgia Tech. That's getting a lot of attention. This hour, On Point, online learning and the future of higher education. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you pursued a higher education online? How has that worked out for you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Oh, there was a lot of expectation, still is. But these things go up and down. This was 2012. Anant Agarwal, creator of the massive open online course provider edX, made the claim that online education would revolutionize the education industry.
Online education for students around the world will be the next big thing in education. This is the single biggest change in education since the printing press.
Bigger, and many, of course, are in there. Here's Yale professor Amy Hungerford introducing her class on the American novel since 1945. Yale taped the course, put the syllabus and homework assignments online as part of their Yale Open Courses Initiative.
This is American Novel Since 1945. Welcome, I'm Amy Hungerford. This course is being filmed as part of the Open Yale Courses Initiative. This is one of 8 courses being offered this year that are being videotaped. They will be made available free to the public via the internet. So this is a way of allowing the world to benefit from what we all do at Yale.
Log on from anywhere in the world and boom, you're in the classroom with Amy Hungerford. Sounds pretty fantastic. Of course, there are many, many different flavors of this. Not all of them have been so well received. April of this year, students filed suit against George Washington University over its online programs, alleged they were promised classes with expert instructors equivalent to a classroom experience. Tuition was more than $28,000. Here's Bryce Bradford, who enrolled in George Washington University's online master's program, and Hassan Zafari, attorney representing the students, in an interview with NBC4's Susan Hogan.
First impression for all of us was, wait a minute. Where's the instructor?
They were incredibly disappointed. Now the students are part of a lawsuit accusing the university of fraudulent misrepresentation.
They absolutely did not get what they were promised.
Mixed picture out there. Joining me now from Washington is Jeff Young, senior editor and writer for The Chronicle on higher education, host of the Relearning podcast. Jeff Young, welcome to On Point.
Hi, great to be here.
Where are we in the arc of, I don't know, acceptance, adoption, distribution of online higher education?
Well, yeah, and as you mentioned, 2012, just a few years ago, there was really this huge hype cycle that emerged, and people were saying that kind of something, you know, this comparison to the history
printing
of the printing
press.
Yeah, and that's those are pretty,
pretty
grand
big. Internet's
claims.
Pretty big.
And the big word at the time was MOOC. Some of your listeners might know it. It's a massive open online courses.
Yep.
And these were basically taking these were a lot of famous universities, highly selective universities, and saying, we're going to take video lectures and assignments and make them open to everyone. Mm-hmm. So the idea was, you know, if these very expensive undergraduate experiences could be free to everyone, well, this might open undergraduates to education to the world and to places, to people that had never had that access. But, you know, I think, as you say, where are we? There was then, you know, when that didn't happen, there was...
It didn't? I thought it did. I mean, we just heard one right there. Well, didn't it? I mean, a lot of people put courses online. There are a lot out there right now.
Right. I guess I mean the revolution where everyone in the world suddenly has a high caliber undergraduate education.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that, you know, there was a column by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times that said this would be a tsunami of educational attainment. And of course, there are interesting things happening with online education, as you alluded to. But the sort of open promise, the first initial promise was one that was just so big. And it's kind of a silver bullet promise, which, you know, as we know, these never end up working out. And when you looked a couple years into these first MOOC experiments, which, you know, it was eye-popping, some of the numbers. There'd be, you know, some of these courses had 160,000 people in one, you know, artificial intelligence class. And so that definitely got people's attention. But then On one level, completion rates were often very low on these because people are just signing up for no credit. And so it would be like 7%, 8% would finish. And if any in-person class had a 93% failure rate, you know, that wouldn't be something to be bragging about.
Nope.
And then you also had the demographics of who ended up taking these courses. Instead of serving people who had no degree, which was kind of the initial dream, but it was the vast majority of people that took these first online free courses. They were people who already had a college degree. And in fact, some early stats pointed to some of them had already graduate degrees, or I think 7% on one study found that people already had PhDs and they actually were probably professors trying to learn about the teaching technique as much as people trying to get an under. So it hasn't really proved a replacement for the undergraduate degree, these free courses. And now, that was the thing that people are kind of moving on from that promise. And I think for some people, it means that nothing interesting came of these MOOCs. But to be honest, there have actually been a continued experimentation by all kinds of colleges, and some interesting things are happening.
I want to look at exactly what's going on. I mean, free courses, were those ever intended to be degree courses? Were some of them, what portion of the online higher ed was aimed at a degree in the last few years?
So these new programs, these MOOCs got a lot of media attention because it was from top name universities. Stanford was one of the first ones, MIT, Harvard. Mm-hmm. And they were offering a lot of these for no credit, and it was simply a way for people to learn. And so some people even compared them to textbooks or things that could just be, you know, or a library. Mm-hmm. And as we know, libraries didn't necessarily make colleges go away. But your question about online education, the interesting thing, and a lot of people at colleges that weren't these highly selective colleges pointed out that for now more than a decade, even before any MIT or Harvard got in the game, there were colleges doing online degrees that were not massive, that were not free, and so they didn't serve 100,000 plus students. And they, in fact, were kind of a teacher-student ratio of maybe 20 students per class, and they were trying to simulate the classroom online for people who just couldn't get to a campus. And so that has been slowly growing over time. And so it's basically the question is, you know, when how much is that going to play a role, or are people going to see those as effective as the in-person experience that probably most of us had.
I want to look at where the cutting edge is now. I mean, I've seen announcements in the past few days about a bunch of universities launching modular master's degree programs, micromasters, they're calling these. They had a pilot at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, now rolling out more of those. And there's being a lot of attention paid to this master's degree in computer science from Georgia Tech. And we'll talk with key figure in getting that going soon. $7,000 master's degree. That's got a lot of attention. What's going on there? Why so much buzz there?
Well, I think the biggest thing about that program was, for one thing, I think the universities are seeing that degrees are what people want. They, you know, just taking courses for fun is going to limit. And so when people are trying to advance their careers or you know, to choose a program, then they're going to look for an opportunity that is going to get them something that employers will value. And so a number of universities are now looking at these experiments with their free courses, what started with free, and seeing if they can turn them into something that's maybe a lower cost option. Because a lot of the earlier traditional, quote unquote, online education that I mentioned was basically offered at the same exact price because the idea was it's a convenience for students. And so even though you're not getting in person, taking online has a value, and the universities had the professor ratio the same, and so they would charge the same amount. But Georgia Tech is getting attention because this is actually a one-fifth, I think, of the price of what it costs to go to which is a top-rated master's program in computer science.
Sure.
That Georgia Tech offers.
Yeah.
And so that's quite a discount, and that basically opens it up to the idea is there's an initial study the other day that found that who ends up taking that are new students that might not have gone to a computer science master's otherwise, because they wouldn't have relocated or maybe paid the full fare. And so the question then is, can you increase the number of people getting an online basically getting this kind of certification, which the job market, you know, there are jobs for computer science folks.
Those who take this MicroMasters, this master's degree from Georgia Tech, at a fifth of the cost of doing it the old-fashioned way on campus, do they come out with the same degree, Jeff?
Yeah, so they do. They get a degree, and they even participated in, you know, they'll participate in the graduation ceremony at Georgia Tech. Of course, and I believe they don't distinguish it from the traditional in person, and they're trying to make it just as rigorous as what they promise. So of course the question is, will the employers kind of over time accept this as equivalent?
And what about the whole idea of this as a fundamentally disruptive technology for the university system or structure in the United States as we've known it? I mean, you say it hasn't panned out yet, but of course, things take a while. Is that still out there?
Yeah, I think I certainly think there's a wait and see attitude by some. And the question, I think there's this move to, you know, MOOC 2.0 or MOOC, you know, the second generation, because often I sometimes think of like the fax machine when, you know, there were even some publications putting out their dispatches on fax machines and this was going to change everything. But of course that, you know, it turned into other technologies and other ways of time shifting that ended up being more meaningful. And so I think the questions really are whether this can be delivered in a way that people will see as equivalent.
Equivalency. You get the degree. If it's the same degree as those who walked on the quad, it's the same degree. Georgia Tech is doing it right now for one-fifth the cost. A master's in computer science for $7,000. That sounds like a business model breaker if it got enough adoption. We're going to talk with one of the people who has led that effort at Georgia Tech, and we're looking more broadly at online higher education this hour. Jeff Young with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Please stand by there in Washington. Charles Isbell joins us in just a moment from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We are talking this hour about online higher education, how it sometimes fell short of high first expectations, and where it is finding traction right now. Georgia Tech getting a lot of attention, but others as well. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Do you still think online ed will dismantle the brick-and-mortar campus ultimately, or at least bring major change? And where online expectation has fallen short, why has it fallen short? Where it's working, how is it working? How and why is it working? Has it worked for you? Have you taken higher ed online courses? Have you got a degree online? How's that worked out? Jeff Young is with us, senior editor and writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education, author of the book Beyond the MOOC Hype, A Guide to Higher Education's High-Tech Disruption. Charles Isbell joins us in just a moment from Atlanta. Let's get a quick call from Death Valley, California, no less. Leonard, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, thank you. I wanted to tell about my recent experience. I'm 56 years old, and formal education has eluded me.
Okay.
I'm now enrolled in a free university online called University of the People out of Pasadena, California.
What are you studying, Leonard?
It's a business degree.
Okay. How's it going?
It's going just fine. I found the courses to be rigorous and difficult, but very enriching.
When you come out of there with a business degree from the University of the People, what do you expect in terms of, you know, market acceptance of that? Will it get you hired?
I think it will. I think the content of the courses will allow me to present myself in such a way that people will be able to tell that I know what I'm talking about.
And do you feel like you're out on your own, you know, or do you feel sometimes when you're sitting in a class, the class carries you along and maybe encourages you and helps you to learn? How is it sitting with the screen?
To me, that was the most important point about University of the People. I originally thought that I might not get much individual attention at all, and I found that to be the complete opposite. From my instructors, my academic advisors, the administration, and fellow students from all over the world that are currently taking the classes with me, I found to have a great deal of individual attention.
That sounds pretty great. Leonard, in Death Valley, California, I wish you great luck with that. Hope it turns out really well, and I appreciate your call. Jeff Young, stand by. I want to go to Atlanta, Georgia, and Charles Isbell, Senior Associate Dean, Professor of Computing for the College of Computing at Georgia Tech. He helped implement and teach the online Master of Science in Computer Science, Computing. This is the sort of getting headlines all over for its under $7,000 master's degree from Georgia Tech. Charles Isbell, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm a big fan of the show.
Oh, wonderful. Particularly wonderful to have you then. $7,000 for a 30-credit master's in computer science. That sounds like a pretty good deal. Did your administrators go crazy when you proposed that price? Don't they want to make more money than that?
Actually, it was quite the opposite. The entire administration, one of the reasons we decided to go down this path is we wanted to see if MOOCs could live up to their promise and we could offer a high-quality degree of the sort that we normally do on campus at Georgia Tech without charging an arm and a leg for it. So we actually sat down and worked out what the actual cost of the degree would be and came up with the price that was just slightly above what our estimates were.
I'm looking here at this report that says a 30-credit master's in computer science from the University of Southern California runs $57,000. Syracuse, Johns Hopkins, Carnegie Mellon, New York Times reporting your charge over $43,000 for that degree. How did you come to a $7,000 figure, even less?
Well, so there's a lot that goes behind it, but really it comes down to one simple thing, scale. So the price that we came up with only makes sense if you're going to have a lot of students in the program, thousands upon thousands of students. If we were sticking to our normal size program, maybe 400 students, then this would not be enough money to cover our costs.
So what kind of scale have you achieved?
Well, at this point, we have just shy of 4,000 students who enroll in about 1.3 courses a term. So we're seeing pretty close to 10,000 enrollments a year. And that's about where we need to be in order to break even and do well.
This is a popular degree right now. People in all kinds of fields are saying to themselves for employment prospects, to have a computer science wing to my kit would be a pretty good thing. Are they really getting the same degree as those who study on campus? And what are you seeing or foreseeing about their job prospects coming out of your online offering?
So the jobs prospects is an interesting question because like many of the questions that you would naturally want to ask about a degree program like this, they don't quite make sense for the population. So let me tell you a little bit about the population.
Okay.
So the first thing that's worth noting about this population is they're about 10, 11 years older than the typical on-campus students.
Mm-hmm.
They're in their 30s as opposed to being in their 20s. The vast majority of them are working full-time.
Okay.
While they're pursuing this degree. So they already have jobs. So if you ask me how many of them are going to have jobs after they get this degree, the answer is almost all of them because they already had
jobs.
They're
mid-career, but they want to step up and maybe they want to change careers.
Right. And by the way, you are getting a lot of that. A lot of our students tell us that they're doing this because they want to change career or they want to have a different kind of impact on the company they're a part of. I'll tell you a really quick story.
Mm-hmm.
I met with a student a couple of days ago who works for a large company who you'd recognize. And he was telling me that, you know, he's 10 or 15 years out of school. He decided to pursue this degree, took my machine learning class, took a lot of AI courses, went to his people up the chain and said, I think I've learned some things. We could do some things different here. We could do some analysis. We could do some really cool things. They said, you're not thinking big enough. We want you to put together a huge team. We want you to help us completely rethink the way that we do analysis of everything about the way that we do business. He put together a team and he's now leading that effort. So he didn't get a job, but he has been able to have a huge impact, a huge change in his own career, and change the way business is done in his own company. And I think those are the kind of success stories that we're beginning to see now that the program's 3 years old.
Are you getting hate mail from other universities who may charge, you know, several times what you're charging for what looks to be a comparable education, comparable degree?
Not at all. We're getting a lot of questions about how we were able to get the degree cost down to where we were, the process we went through to get the faculty on board, and how it is that we actually managed to maintain quality.
And you've got 4,000 or so, you said, now students in that, if I've got the number right. Is that the scale you need to sustain this, or are you still working toward the scale you'll need to sustain that price point?
No, we're right at the place where we need to be in order to break even and be able to continue this.
Is it really the same degree? Is it indistinguishable from the degree I would get if I came to Georgia Tech and studied on campus?
Absolutely. It's the same courses taught by the same faculty, put together by the same set of people. I teach two of the courses. One of them I teach on campus every year. I give exactly the same assignments. I give exactly the same tests. I have exactly the same discussions. I use the same jokes. Everything is the same.
Jeff Young, do you hear other universities applauding or freaking out that Georgia Tech is undercutting the price point that many would put on this? It could be three, four, five times as much or more.
Yeah, well, I certainly haven't seen others copy it yet. I think, like Charles said, I think a lot of people are watching to see how it all goes and whether it cannibalizes the kind of full-paying students. And so it'll be interesting if there is another basically, is there another group or population of students who already have a job and may not be willing to pay the full price but might be seeking out this kind of different option that can be done from wherever they are?
There's so much I want to learn about here. We've got a lot of callers for the two of you as well, if I may bring some of them right now. Lisa in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Lisa, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Nice to hear you.
You too. What's your history?
I was just calling to share my experience. I graduated from an online master's program in instructional design two years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed learning about how to create effective online courses. And I feel like my online education experience was comparable or equivalent to going on campus and learning the same material.
How's it worked out for you professionally, Lisa?
Well, professionally, it's been a little hard. The degree cost as much as if I had been on campus, so it was quite an investment. And to be going into the field of education, you don't get a huge return on that investment.
Yep.
So I've been fortunate that Obama has the 10-year public service loan forgiveness. So I'm looking to work in public service for the next 10 years to pay off that.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, I've still only been able to teach in brick and mortar schools, and I'm looking to move into the virtual environment, but haven't had luck yet.
Georgia Tech is offering their computer science master's for $7,000. How does that broadly compare to what you paid for your master's degree, Lisa?
That I think that would be about a tenth of what I paid for my master's degree. And that was from a public in-state university that my master's cost almost six figures.
So that's a really interesting story. Jeff Young, what does it mean if you've got some schools, Georgia Tech, offering a master's for $7,000, others offering it for 10 times that? Can everybody keep playing in this game? Or do some get cut out? Is there a lower cost model that Georgia Tech's found here that's going to push other colleges out of digital education if they can't bring their costs way down?
Well, I think the question of whether this is a model that is going to be continued by others, it gets a little bit back to how colleges can afford to set up all the costs to create an online master's program the way Georgia Tech did. And they had an interesting model where they actually worked with a couple outside for-profit partners that one of them is Udacity, which was one of these early MOOC providers. And they even had, I believe, some investment from AT&T. And the question for colleges that really want to make a state-of-the-art brand new program is how do you get the money to the millions in some cases to get it started, and how do you get the scale to get the number of students that if you don't have that scale, as was said earlier, then you're not going to be able to offer it at the low price. And so it's a kind of do colleges have the system to make those kinds of investments in something that they haven't traditionally had to do before, because it's not brick and mortar, they can't just simply add a couple faculty members and add a little capacity as they've done with in-person courses.
We're looking at online higher education and where that stands in the age of the $7,000, there's a bargain, master's degree. Charles Isbell, how did you do it? How did you raise the money to get this going, and how did you get to scale?
Well, we told a great story, I think. There's a couple of things that I think are worth pointing out. Jeff mm-hmm. is exactly right that we were able to do this in part because of partnerships with Udacity and partnerships with AT&T. We could have done it without Udacity, but it would have taken us two more years because we simply didn't have the platform and the technology to bring it online quickly.
Is Udacity an online ed platform company, or is it a school in itself? Forgive me.
It's an online platform. They're the ones who host our videos. They're the ones who do the video editing. They do all of the things that turn it into a production. They're your engineers. Yep. They're your producers. Mm-hmm. We could have done it without AT&T, but it would have cost a lot of money for all the upfront costs. See, when I tell you that scale is what allows us to do what we do, it's because there's some fixed costs. So creating a course costs $150,000 to $250,000. Mm-hmm. But that's a cost you pay once and you don't have to pay it again for 5, 6, 7, or 8 years.
Right.
If that cost is fixed and you have 4,000 students who are a part of your program, then even if they pay a little bit, they completely overwhelm the original cost. Mm-hmm. So this is why scale actually matters. So by working with AT&T, we were able to deal with our upfront costs immediately and move quickly towards producing as many courses as possible and to provide the scale. Without them, we could have done it, but it would have been slower going. It wouldn't have been as quick, and it frankly just wouldn't have been as good as quickly as we were able to do.
What's AT&T get out of it?
Well, one, they get to get mentioned on your show, which they might not have been mentioned otherwise.
Yeah.
The other thing is they have a huge workforce. They want them to get the latest, greatest, cutting-edge education that's out there. Machine learning, as we know it today, didn't exist in the same form 10 years ago. Now it does. We offer courses in that. Their students are able to take advantage of this at a really, really low cost.
But you're not promising them that you are a pipeline for them, or are you?
No, we absolutely are not. It turns out that if you look at the statistics in terms of other companies that are who send their employees here, more come from AT&T than any other company. But if you look at things like the acceptance rates, it's exactly the same as everyone else. So they got no special dispensation for being a part of the program, but they are taking advantage of it more than lots of other companies are.
I'm wondering if this is delivering on the promise to get a higher education to more individuals, or let me get a caller here. Mike in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
I would agree that with one of the speakers earlier that I teach at an online program out of Columbia.
Great.
South Carolina, Columbia College, and we are finding that our program offers the convenience and the flexibility that attracts students who might not otherwise be in the education system. So I think it's more evolutional maybe than revolutionary, if that makes sense. It's I don't think it will ever supplant the traditional undergrad, 4-year experience straight out of high school, so to speak. But we're bringing a lot of folks in who are working professionals who, if it weren't for our program, they wouldn't be able to go back to school, period. So they're really an additional student body rather than in any way dramatically impacting the traditional 4-year students. I'm just wondering if that cuts across all the programs, if that's something they've seen nationwide, or if that's just unique to our situation.
We'll pick it up, Mike. You say it's possible. You make that possible because they can do the studying and the coursework whenever they like, or because you're at a lower price point?
We're at a similar price point. We tag ours to the other state schools here in South Carolina, mm-hmm. but there are no book fees. We did a similar, we farm out our IT infrastructure with a firm, so but they get a Chromebook, and each course every 5 weeks is sent to their Chromebook. It's all online, and the biggest thing is that it's asynchronous. There is a weekly schedule. There are deadlines to meet, like in all college courses, but how you work within that week is entirely up to the student. So if you've got I teach terrorism, criminal justice, things along, I'm still a practicing professional in that area, which is another difference between a lot of the online programs. The instructors are credentialed, but still practicing as professionals. It's kind of an attractive thing for folks who are credentialing mid-career for promotional purposes or even trying to change careers.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they can work however they want within that week, whereas if you're a working cop doing 12-hour shifts, 48 or 60 hours a week, you're not going to be able to sit in the classroom with 18-year-olds Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m. So it's just a different model. I think it really exposes a whole new swath of the populace to a college education who might not have been exposed to that before.
Mike, I really appreciate your call from South Carolina. Charles Isbell, I wonder what you're thinking there. Is it the asynchronous face that makes this most attractive or open to a new brand of students? Is it the cost? What drives it?
So the cost helps, but I think your caller was exactly right. Look, the Harvard study shows that almost none of the students who came to our program would have gone to another program if this program didn't exist. Right? So it is the case that what we're really pushing for here in the end is access. And affordability is only a small part of that access. Now you can do education anywhere, wherever you are in the world.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the latest in emerging markets to finding the next big computing platform, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about online higher education and how it is developing. There was a lot of hype early on, some disappointment, but things are moving forward. Georgia Tech, very highly ranked tech education school, now offers a $7,000 master's in computer science, and that's getting a lot of attention, maybe one-eighth the price of some of its competitors. Charles Isbell has been right at the heart of that. He's senior associate dean there and joins us today from Atlanta, Georgia. Jeff Young is with us as well, senior editor and writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, author of Beyond the MOOC Hype, massive open online courses that got so much attention when they first rolled out a couple of years ago. You can join us this hour. Have you taken online college courses? How's it gone? Have you taught online? How's that? And do you see online ed changing the way college works, for better, for worse? Ariana's calling from Boston. Hi, Ariana. You're on the air. What's your story?
Hi, Tom. A few points I wanted to say. First of all, I work in higher education, and I have a doctorate in higher ed from a hybrid program,
okay,
meaning it was mostly online with some courses in a satellite campus.
Okay.
So large school, large public school in Florida, and then I took some classes in the Boston area. So the hybrid experience was really positive for me to have a little bit of both the flexibility of online.
How did you find it, Dr. Ariana? You got your PhD out of it. You got that.
I did. I found the student support piece really valuable. I felt really supported by the institution, even though it was large, even though it was thousands of miles away and I never went. But in reference to the other caller, it was not affordable in the least, close to six figures.
Okay.
A couple other points. With the MOOCs, the Massive Open Online Courses, I don't believe they will ever take over the online market, especially because there is a huge cheating problem as well as a lack of completion problem. And in most cases, they don't lead to credit anyway. So they're really just more for enrichment, and they're not going to take over, in my opinion.
But you got a PhD out of it, and how's that working for you in the job market? It's a hybrid. Is it just as respected as any other, Ariana, as far as you can see?
Absolutely. It helped me get my current job, and it's looked upon quite positively. I think it's going to suit me well, you know, as I advance in my career. And one more piece is that I work for a small urban quality higher education institution in graduate admissions, and we would not be able to do the $7,000 program just because I don't think 4,000 students is almost quadruple the amount of graduate students we have total. So while it is a nice thing, a small urban school, we would not be able to support the more affordable model.
Yeah, nice if you can get it, but hard to achieve that scale or even bigger. Ariana, I really appreciate your call. Charles Isbell in Atlanta, Georgia. What about the two? We get the compliments there, and she's got her doctorate. What about the cheating problem she points to and the completion problem? There were some very low rates of completion early on in some of these things.
Right. So the cheating thing is actually pretty straightforward. There are lots of proctoring services that involve human beings, that involve machines. So when someone takes an exam in my course, they have to get into a room. They have to install something on their computer. The program takes over their machine entirely, takes over their camera, watches their every move. They have to show a form of ID, two forms of ID if they're not from the United States, mm-hmm. and it records every single thing that they do, and it flags anything that looks suspicious. So in fact, the students who take our online exams go through a much more rigorous screening process than the ones who take our on-campus exams, who just walk in and sit down and claim to be whoever it is they claim to be.
Yep.
So I get the concern, but it's in practice not a real problem for us, at least as far as we can tell. as far as what was the other question?
Completion.
So completion is an interesting question. For the MOOCs originally, you were losing 93-97% of students. That's because there wasn't anything in particular they were needing to complete. I've started lots of books without finishing them.
Yeah.
For our program, we seem to have a melt of something less than 20%. So about 20% of the students in any given semester drop a course. But the vast majority of them come back the next semester and take either that course or take some other course. So we're doing slightly worse than we would on campus, but we're seeing completion rates that are pretty impressive.
Charles Isbell, please stand by there. And Jeff Young, John Murray joins us right now, Brookline, Massachusetts, a recent graduate from the online master's program in global health at Northwestern University, about to begin an online master's in public policy from George Washington University, already has a PhD from the University of Texas, Austin, 28 years in the Air Force, been around. John Murray, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You've got a doctorate. You just got another master's from Northwestern in, what, Chicago, Evansville, I guess, and now you're going to do yet another one in public policy from GW. You sound like a big enthusiast. Why are you pushing forward with so much digital education, John?
Well, I concur with your other callers that the online programs are just as robust and challenging as what you would find in the traditional classroom. As somebody who studies global health, what I have found most valuable is the faculty in the program are highly distinguished. They're individuals who have worked in developing countries such as Mali, Nigeria, Kenya, and South Africa. And many of the guest faculty also come from other countries. Being the online program for global health also provides enhanced class discussions in that we really do get a unique opportunity to gain an in-depth understanding of our classmates' views. My former classmates were from varying backgrounds, such as medicine, law, technology, research, and they were from different countries, so they brought the real-world experience. I had students in my program that were from West Africa, Nepal, China, Philippines, and Germany. You can't get a better experience than that.
And do you get a chance to really interact with them, John, online?
Yes, all the time. So we actually had projects where we collaborated with individuals from different countries and from different disciplines.
And not just, are you just typing that, or are you on there face-to-face over your computer screen?
We could do both. It's really up to the students what is the preferred way to get the assignment completed. But from my perspective, I thought that the face-to-face or the online with individuals was much more effective and helpful.
How would you compare the rigor and quality of the online education you've done versus, let's say, your PhD out of UT Austin?
Yeah, I think that the rigor has been just as high is what I have found in this program.
That's pretty impressive. John Murray, good luck with it all. We really appreciate your being with us for a minute today.
Thank you, Tom.
Charles, is this scalable beyond Georgia Tech and a few big others? If you guys get scaled, does that mean others are just plumb out of luck?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to know for sure, but it's definitely the case that there are other fields that are like this and there are other universities that can do this and perhaps not do it for the cost we're doing if they can't scale, but they can certainly do it for less than they're on campus. I mean, there's a real secret here. You've been talking about the price of the program, which is eye-catching and is something that we're proud of, but what we're more proud of is access. You know, there's a joke that my dean likes to tell, which is, how can you tell the difference between a good university and a bad university? Well, a good university, the output isn't much worse than the input, right? So the way you get to be a good university is you get good students in and you don't let anyone in you don't think is near perfect. What we're trying to do here is we're trying to admit every single student we believe who can succeed. So for our on-campus program, we admit about 10% of the students. About 60 or 70% of them are qualified. We just don't have the room. Online, we're admitting about 60% of those students. And you know what's amazing to me is not just that they're out there, but they're doing just as well as the on-campus students. And I wish we could admit the other 50% of the on-campus students as well and give access to all the people who are trying to better their lives through education.
So who are you reaching? Can you give us a profile or profiles of who you're reaching that you might not otherwise have in your fold?
Well, there are two big numbers here, I think, that sort of explain it. One is that they're older. They're working full-time. I mentioned that earlier. Mm-hmm. But the other one actually is where they're from. So for our on-campus program, about 85% of the applicants are foreign nationals. Vast majority of them are from India and China. Very few from the United States. For our online program, 85% of the applicants are U.S. citizens or permanent residents. So we're not just getting older students. We're getting older students from the United States who otherwise would not be pursuing a graduate degree that they wish they could pursue. But, you know, they live in California instead of Georgia. They've got two kids, a mortgage, and a full-time job, and they're just not going to be able to walk away from that to pay $46,000 and to spend 2 years to get a graduate degree, and now they can.
Jeff Young, we've got this brand new report out of Harvard's Kennedy School saying that it's got the first evidence that online education affects the number of people pursuing formal education. Demand for online option is driven, they say, by mid-career Americans. And saying that their research suggests that low-cost, high-quality online options may open opportunities for populations who would not otherwise pursue education. There's the access question. Is it proving out? Their research says so. Is the general perception that the access issue, which is supposed to be a big piece of this, is panning out?
Well, actually, I think the interesting thing about the stat you just mentioned from the Harvard study was that this is actually a surprise that it was opening up the access, because the early promise of MOOCs, these free online courses, was that it would get new people into the education system that maybe hadn't been, that had been shut out in some way. And the early findings were that that wasn't bringing new people in. And so I think you mentioned the kind of up and down of online learning. The access issue has been one that people are raising questions about. Who does this benefit, and, you know, the redesign for whom? And I think certainly these courses seem to be very helpful for a lot of mid-career students in these graduate programs, and that seems to be where the success is happening. And it hasn't been so far that the undergraduate experience has been transformed, as some callers have said. And so the question then is the broader question of higher education's role, is there a way for people who are underserved or people who are not able to succeed in some of these undergraduate programs, can there be an online alternative that helps them as well?
There's a big question. We're looking at online higher education. Debbie in Boston. Debbie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I wanted to share what Berklee College of Music is doing online. We've been teaching music online for 15 years through Berklee Online. We've priced the tuition to be 60% less than the campus tuition, so it's a wonderful affordability option for students. We have students who have left Berklee before they completed their degree coming back online to finish their degree. We're reaching 9,000 students per year in our courses, certificate programs, and online degree programs.
What about student satisfaction, Debbie? When I think of studying music, at some point I think of being in a room with other musicians. If I'm online, does that happen? Do they have the same satisfaction level?
Absolutely. We survey our students twice per semester, per 12-week semester in every course, and we have a high 90% satisfaction rate. We design the courses around project-based learning, so every week students are doing real-world musical projects, uploading those projects and gaining, you know, recorded critiques from their instructors, and they use those portfolios to actually get career opportunities, so it works really well for them.
So there's another school diving in. Debbie, I really appreciate your call. Charles, does this, or if so, when does this begin to bite into the old model and say, you know what, we don't need as many seats and as much green grass and as many brick buildings. We're going to go in another direction. Is there a point at which it actually blows that model up? There's a lot of dissatisfaction among Americans coming out with very high student debt loads. Does it take that apart?
Well, I don't know if it takes it apart. I mean, that remains to be seen, but I do think it provides an alternative. I think if you ask yourself, what is it you get out of an undergraduate education? You get a couple of things, right? You get a credential, you get an education, and you also get a network. You get an opportunity to talk to others.
Yeah.
All of these things are available online. The networking is available online. The students create their own community. It's certainly a possibility. We stuck at the graduate level because we thought we understood it. We could move slowly in that space, and we could decide whether it made sense to move out through the to the undergraduate mm-hmm. programs, perhaps our PhD programs. And right now, I guess all I can say is that it's promising, and I think it's already changed the conversations that we're having around higher education, and I think it's going to continue to do so. Will universities look completely different in 50 years? Maybe. Will this be the cause of it? This will certainly be a part of the story.
Jeff, not everybody loves this. I know some colleges are now requiring students to take undergrads to take some portion of their course load online, and not everybody really likes it. Do you see that trend, Jeff? That hey, okay, welcome, you're in, and here's your opportunity, but you're going to have to take 20% of your courses online. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I certainly haven't seen it in that large of numbers, but there are some universities that are encouraging or even requiring students to take at least one course in an online setting. And part of their argument, I think, is that it will prepare them for the format in some ways. But you referenced earlier, there are certainly some students who would rather take the traditional in-person face-to-face and feel like they're paying full fare, they want the traditional experience. And so I think that there's a question about whether students will revolt in larger numbers, although so far, students, there are plenty of examples where students are actually choosing the online option, even if it's not required, even if they're in an on-campus setting, which has surprised a lot of people, the number of students who, even if they're on campus, want to take an online.
Do you see a model breaker emerging at some point here? I mean, there's so much woe and gnashing of teeth about the debt students are coming out with. If Georgia Tech can give you a master's for $7,000, people are going to say, well, what can you do for me in undergraduate? Or, does this at some point break that business model, to put it just so bluntly, of that's the American standard?
Yeah, that is such an interesting question. And the initial, watching that has been so interesting to see these various experiments and sort of tiptoe into this, will there be a big model change? I think the structural questions, though, that we've mentioned, I mean, universities are built the way they are and they've evolved, and people praise the United States for having such a dynamic higher ed system, but they also, it's built up a lot of, there's a lot of autonomy by faculty members, and there are a lot of ways in which they run that these new programs, creating them by having to go out and raise millions of dollars or having to go get programs approved very quickly, it challenges and it requires a different way of thinking. And so the question is, are universities going to change, and how fast can that happen?
The pressure's there. The future awaits. Jeff Young at the Chronicle of Higher Education, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Charles Isbell, Senior Associate Dean, Professor of Computing at the College of Computing at Georgia Tech, where they're doing that master's now for $7,000. Congratulations on hitting that price point. We will keep watching, and thank you very much for joining us today, Professor Isbell.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, Maeve Pajess, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Halima Gikandi and Weiwa Lee. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.